Good morning, everyone.
We're reading in Book 1, Canto 4, and we've come into the third section of that canto, and we stopped on page 59, line 467. An outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. Sri Aurobindo has been telling us about the powers of the spirit who are in a way so remote from us, they're untouched by our sorrow and our tears. But those pure strengths are upholding all this universe. And it doesn't mean that we are just left alone. A spiritual secret aid is there. And while a tardy evolution's coils wind on, and nature hews her way through adamant, a divine intervention thrones above. We are not abandoned, and our globe is not a casual, meaningless globe. This outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. And it's keeping safe for us the one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change. Whatever happens to us in the course of our development through many lives, that hand is holding on to us, on for us, to that divine fulfillment which was promised to our struggling souls when they agreed to take part in this evolutionary experiment. The Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. We can read on from there. Patricia, you'll start today.
Where would you like?
No, 475.
I'm sorry.
Line 475. Mm. One who has shaped this world.
One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our miseries. Whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and veil, a mighty guidance leads us still through all.
Thank you. These are such reassuring and comforting lines. We can always remember them when things become too challenging and too difficult. The fulfillment is inevitable, and whether we are aware of it or not, whatever the appearances we must bear, whatever the strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but death and bale, ill will, misfortune, disaster, still a mighty guidance leads us still through all.
The repetition is interesting. He works through.
Yes, he's working through all these things, no? The fierce vicissitudes, all these shocking and challenging things that happen to us, through all the battle and toil that we have to pass through, even if we're not actually soldiers on the physical battlefield. Still, life is a battle. Life in the present state of evolution of this material universe. And even through our sins, when we feel we've made terrible mistakes and somehow separated ourselves, cut ourselves off from the divine, he's still working through all that, our sins and sorrows and our tears. We don't know what's going on. We make our plans and have our hopes and dreams, but his knowledge overrules our nescience, our not knowing. So in this way, this mighty guidance is always leading us through everything that happens towards a divine fulfillment. Jocelyn, would you read the next lines, please? In the passage that we read last week, Shobindo was telling us about two extremes that seem to be forever separate. And he told us that this is our greatest need to reconnect them. At one end of existence are the spirit's bare and absolute potencies burning in the solitude of the thoughts of God. He explained how remote they are from us and how they are indifferent to our prayers and tears and sufferings. Their task is to guard the silence of the truth, to keep safe the unchangeable decree, the command that was set into this manifestation at its beginning. At peace regarding the trouble beneath the stars. I'm reading at the bottom of page 57. Deathless, watching the works of death and chance. Immobile, seeing the millenniums pass. Untouched while the long map of fate unrolls. They look on our struggle with impartial eyes, and yet without them, cosmos could not be this universe which is a totality and a harmony. So on the next page, page 58, Sri Aurobindo explained the role that these powers of the spirit play, upholding everything, encouraging us to aspire towards our higher selves. And then he reassured us, but the fact that they are so remote and impersonal, it doesn't mean that we are left alone in this universe. No. There's always this divine help and intervention and guidance. And now he's telling us that when we have played our roles, when our souls have fulfilled their missions, served this great divided world, something is waiting for us. God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right, our birthright, which nothing can take away from us. There's even a date fixed. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown. We don't know what that date is and when it will come, but he's promising us that it will come. and it'll be an anniversary of the sublime birth of the incarnation of the Supreme in the universe. Then we shall realize that our souls, their checkered walk, all the difficulties and delights that it's passed through. Checkered means alternating dark and light. It will all be justified. We shall see that it was all worthwhile. And all those high things that now seem not to exist for us, or to be so far away that we can't touch them, they will all come near to us, close to us. And when that date comes, these calm and distant mights, these pure and absolute potencies of the Spirit, they will act at last. They will no longer be immobile. Now they are immovably ready for their destined task. They are waiting, these ever-wise, compassionate brilliances. They are waiting for a call. They are waiting for the sound of the incarnate's voice, the transcendent mounting his throne, revealing himself in the material world. And then they will leap down and make a great bridge across these chasms, these terrible, uncrossable depths of ignorance, and heal the hollow, yearning gulfs of life, the emptiness at the heart of life. They will fill this abyss that is the universe. They will fill it with their bliss and oneness. So those are the Spirit's bare and absolute potencies at one end of existence. At the other end of the existence, there is something else, which he's going to describe next. Tomoko, will you read? Page 60 at the top. Here, meanwhile, it's page 60, top line.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, yes, Audrey.
Okay, in here it says, our soul shall justify its checkered walk.
Yes.
And when you read that, you said, realize its checkered walk.
No, what I meant is, when we really contact the soul and have a memory of its history in the world, then we see that everything was justified, that it was necessary to the process of development, our own development and the development of the universe. So, when something is justified, you see that, oh, it was right, it was necessary. It's like that. So that's what I meant when I said realized. But of course he says justify. Because that sense of justification comes. He refers to it and describes it at several places in the poem. And I have heard people who've had this experience describing it. The panorama of everything that has happened to the soul, and how it all makes sense, and you say yes to it all. So at the moment of fulfillment, it's like that.
It just seems like two very different words in the mind.
I think it's the same experience, anyway. So, but what is at the spirit's opposite pole? At one pole of the spirit are those bare and absolute potencies. What's happening meanwhile at this opposite pole that is our experience? Tomoko.
Here, meanwhile, at the spirit's opposite pole, in the mystery of the deeps that God has built, for his abode below the thinker's sight, in this compromise of a stark, absolute truth, is a light that dwells near the dark end of things. In this transient comedy of this long far seeking for joy ever near, in the grandiose dream of which the world is made, in this gold dawn on black dragon base, a conscious force that acts in nature's rest, a dark road laborer in the cosmic scheme, carrying clay images of unborn gods, executrix of the inevitable idea, hampered, enveloped by the hoops of faith, patient trustee of slow, eternal time, absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. All she foresees in masked, imperturbable gift, the dumb intention of the unconscious gods, answers to a will that sees upon the heights and the evolving words, first syllable, ponderous, root sensed, contains its luminous clues, privy to a summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise.
Thank you. Yes.
What does carrying clay images upon dark gods?
We'll give ourselves time to read it all again quietly to ourselves, and then I'll answer questions. No, it's all right. It's all right. Thank you. What a wonderful passage. Just two sentences. At the opposite pole, there's the spirit's bare and absolute potentices. This is a description of here. Here, meanwhile, at this opposite pole of the two, no, the twain that seem to be ever parted so that they can't come together. Here, in the deeps, the deep, dark places that God has built for his abode, for him to live in, below the sight of the thinker, below the level of waking mind, on these lower levels, God is living, but what is manifested is a compromise of a stark, absolute truth, that's those bare and absolute potencies at one end. There has to be a compromise with another kind of light, the light that dwells near the dark end of things. In the Vedas, they talk about the sun hidden in the darkness. And we read about the spirit's sun digging a tunnel through emergency. There's a compromise between these two kinds of light. What we experience is a tragicomedy. A tragedy is a drama that ends badly with tears. And a comedy is a drama that ends in laughter. And our English poet Shakespeare invented tragicomedy, where both these things happen in the same play. So before Shakespeare invented those dramas, God invented this tragicomedy, where he's playing all the roles in his divine disguise. What's happening here, meanwhile, is this long, far seeking. The whole world yearns for bliss. But he says that joy actually is always near us, but still we are searching for it as if it was beyond our reach. In this grandiose dream of which our world, the material world, the human world, is made, in this gold dome on a black dragon base. Mother has asked Huta to make a painting of this line. You can see it. The the black dragon of the inconscient. But on the base of that black dragon of unconscious matter, a golden dome of thought and aspiration and longing has been built. Here, meanwhile, in this world, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast, the conscious force that is the executive of the supreme will, she carries out the decree of the divine. She works in a dark robe, humbly, as a laborer in this cosmic scheme, in this universal plan. And what she's doing at the moment is she's carrying clay images of unborn gods, images made of matter, pure matter, but maybe also living matter. Those unborn gods are in us. She's carrying them and nursing them and helping them to grow. She is the executrix, carrying out the inevitable idea, the idea which has formed this universe. Her work is not easy. She is hampered. She has to face all kinds of difficulties. She's enveloped. It's as if she's surrounded by iron hoops, like a barrel. So it's very, very difficult for her to move freely. These are the hoops of material determinism, fate, the things that can't be changed. But she is the patient trustee of slow, eternal time. She's carrying out from hour to hour her secret charge, her responsibility, the task which she has accepted. In her depths, which are masked, hidden from us, but which are imperative, they are coded with a task that has to be done, she can foresee all that is to come. She knows that the dumb intention of the unconscious gulfs answers to a will that sees upon the heights. What is coded into those unconscious gulfs corresponds to a seeing will on the highest levels of consciousness. Last week we read about this word, the word with its three syllables. We are only aware of one part of that three-syllabled word. But here Sri Aurobindo is saying that the first syllable, we could say the first syllable is unconscious matter, perhaps. But it's an evolving word. It's being spoken gradually. Its first syllable is ponderous, heavy, brute-sensed. What sensations and feelings that it has are very primitive and raw. But still it contains in it the luminous close, the end of the word, which is full of light. So that conscious force which toils in nature's breast is privy. She knows a secret. Kings used to have privy counselors, the closest confidants, the people who knew only the most, who knew the most secret things. That conscious force which acts in nature's breast is privy. She knows the secret that a victory is waiting on the very peaks of existence. It will descend. There'll be a vast descent. And a sign of that vast descent is a portent. A portent is a sign or a signal that's foretelling or indicating something that will happen. The soul's immense uprise, the fulfillment of its evolutionary journey from total involvement in unconscious matter up through life and mind to the heights of the spirit. So those clay images of unborn gods, they are us.
They are within us.
Yeah, well, they are in fact our bodies. Okay. She's carrying us, and the unborn gods, the possibility of our divinity is within them. Have we read these next sections? Yes. So we'll go ahead then. Audrey.
All appears from each thing seems to illumine itself. The figures of the soul transcend forms. Moved by him there are. His breath is their life. An unseen presence molds.
Thank you. In this canto, Sri Aurobindo is gradually revealing to us, step by step, the secret knowledge which underlies the whole poem, which underlies his vision, which underlies the Vedantic tradition in India. So here he comes at it from another angle or aspect. Everything here seems to us separate. Each thing seems its lonely self. It's just an island of existence. But all of these things are figures, representations, expressions of the One, the transcendent One beyond all limitation, division, separation. All this, can only exist because of him. His breath is their life. And all this clay, all this matter, gets molded into these different forms by his indwelling, unseen presence. It's a beautiful echo of the first line of the Ishupanishad. All this is a habitation for the Lord. Everything that moves in this moving universe, he's living within it, and nothing could move if it were not for his presence. Nothing could exist but if it weren't for his presence. So how has this happened? He's playing a game with his own conscious force, the mighty mother. Sri Aurobindo has spoken of this game as a game of hide and seek between lovers. The One has come upon this dubious whirling globe of the earth, of the universe, and he's hiding from her. He hides in force, in energy, and in form. He's inhabited all this as a secret spirit involved in the sleep of the inconscient, as a shapeless energy, a word that isn't expressed. He's been here before all the elements which make up our physical universe could emerge. Matter didn't exist. Matter as we know it didn't exist. There was no life. There was no light of mind. He's hiding from her, but at the same time, he's her accomplice. Secretly, he's helping her. these forms, these figures of himself, he makes them real by his indwelling presence. And all of these forms are symbols of his truth. And he gives the symbol, the symbols, equal value and importance as the indwelling truth. All these forms are materializations of his timeless thoughts. He gives to his timeless thoughts a form in time. And now he will speak about the relationship between the One and his and the Mighty Mother. Yes, Audrey. Yes.
I have the mother.
Yes.
That's the mother.
The conscious force that works in nature's breast. Yes.
All this long paragraph.
Yes.
And then he writes about what created that whole. Why does he do it the other way around?
He must have felt that this was the most effective way to do it. But it's like, it's a bit like a painter, you know. You know all about this. You have a starting vision, and you can't put it all on the canvas at once. You make a little mark here, and a little mark here, and a little mark here, and in your vision, all these little marks will add up to the complete picture. But if somebody comes into your studio before you finished, they will just see these splotches and not know. It's like that. He's making a little mark here, telling us something. He started off by telling us that a deathless littleness is not all we are, that we have a greater existence within us. Sorry?
I'm actually doing a painting.
You're doing a painting about that, yes.
Where it's finished, but then I cut it up.
So perhaps it's like that. In his vision, of course, it's finished. But how to share it with the people? In the most poetic and powerful way, of course, it's all connected. And we will come to the end of the canto, and we will see how it's all connected. And like King Aswapati, we'll see that this implies another level of knowledge. But this is the basis. First, we have to get this. So this is the next statement. I'm sorry, lady at the back, I've forgotten your name. Behind Audrey. Would you read? He is the substance.
He is the substance. He, the self of things. She has forged him from her works of skill and minds. She wraps him in the magic of her moves and makes of his myriad truths a countless dreams. The master of being has come down to her, an immortal child born in the fugitive years, in objects wrought, in the person she conceives. Dreaming, she chases her idea of him and catches here a look and there a jest. Ever he repeats in them his ceaseless birds. He is the maker and the world he made. He is the vision and he is the seal. He is himself the actor and the act. He is himself the known and the known. He is himself the dreamer and the dream.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
This he and she, both of them, one in the same, transcendent realm and unseen presence,
Well, I think in the very next line from where we stopped, he says, there are two who are one and play in many worlds. So yes, they are one, but they've taken on two roles for the play.
Shadow.
Yes.
It's an immortal child born in the 50 years.
Yes. This is the aspect of the one as the Hiranyagarbha, as the golden embryo. He enters in on the subtle plane, pervading the material world as an embryo, as a child who's developing and growing. He's come down and is in the womb of nature, and she's giving birth to him in these fugitive years, these passing years. She's giving birth to this immortal child, the master of being, in all these different forms, in the objects, in the people, the persons. And she has her dream of him, her master, her lord, and she's chasing her idea of him. And every now and then, like an artist, she's really able to see in her creations a touch of what she was dreaming of. Here a look, and there a jest. And in all these forms, it's the one who is being born eternally, again and again and again. He's the maker, but he's also, there's no one else to be. This world that he has made, it is all made out of himself. No? He is the power of vision, and he's the one who sees that vision realized. He's the energy, the one who acts, and the action too is an expression of himself. He's the one who knows all this, and he is all that is known. He is the dreamer, dreaming all this, and the dream is only his own self. Does it answer your question, Manohar? Yes. Well, if you are immortal, there's no fugitive years. But we are mortal. We have a limited lifespan. And all forms on earth are mortal. They have a limited lifespan. So the years for us are running away.
In time, not in space.
In time, yes. Yes, so these are two aspects, no?
Yeah.
One is the substance, and the other is the indwelling self. Well, yes, yeah, substance is formed of energy, yes.
In the elements also?
Yes, he says before the elements could emerge, no? They are also expressions of the one, of course. All this is a habitation for the Lord. It's so difficult for us to somehow fully realize, because here each thing seems its lonely self. But all are figures of that soul, transcendent one, who is not limited by anything. He's dwelling in every little minutest subatomic particle of force or substance.
This is the understanding that I get. This is that there are no accidents.
Right.
There is one line there. Ever he repeats in them his ceaseless path. Ever he repeats in her and his time. But in them.
It's as if every time a flower is born, emerges, the Lord is inhabiting it. He's being born in it, in every form. In them, it means in the forms.
Here it is written, master of being is unknown to her.
To nature, yes.
To her, nature.
Yeah.
Then he's writing, ever he repeats, in them he sees his words.
Yes.
In them.
So it's them in the forms, no? It refers to the previous lines about the objects and the persons. and nature is chasing her idea of him. And so, because she's the artist and trying to give form for him, he accepts her forms. He takes birth in them, in the look and the jest, in the objects, in the persons. You have to read the whole sentence. Yeah. Is it clear now? Yeah.
Mm. From the 9446 to 550, when I read it, you know, it's not right to say, but I feel he's full of himself.
Yes. Who else is there? There's only the one.
So nothing wrong with being full of himself.
Yes, right.
You know, it is a negative thing. You know, people say, oh, you're full of yourself. He's full of himself.
Right. Always we think of creation as creating something outside of the Creator. No? But Sri Aurobindo is telling us it's not like that. He is himself the substance of everything that's created. And not only the substance, but also the self, the existence of everything. We wouldn't be alive at all if he weren't breathing in us. We couldn't exist at all without his presence forming and shaping us. Yes, Don?
It's frustrating, but how can we in our low level of comprehension understand that he is the maker and he is that which is made?
Well,
makes sense in the
these are mantric lines. These are lines that we can remember. And if we remember and recall them and concentrate on them, we may come to the experience that they express. That's why they're here, for that, yeah, to give us that opportunity.
Yeah. This is Lorraine. I get the impression that God is lonely and has created all of this, and there'll be, we all have a potentiality.
Yes.
It's there.
Yes. These are words that hint at something which is beyond our comprehension, really. No? But they're there to help us have an experience that corresponds to Sri Aurobindo's experience, to the knowledge of the great rishis who have expressed all this before in their own words. This is the secret knowledge that can save us from our human littleness if it becomes real enough for us.
Because it says there is a relationship, not a separation.
Right. Even this word transcendent, we tend to think of it as something beyond the created world, but it isn't. It's absolutely pervading all this. It's omnipresent in everything, in the material worlds and in the subtle worlds. That transcendence is filling and sustaining, pervading everything.
I have a question.
Yes.
So how do we know that when we try to emulate it through our experience? How do we know that when we are trying to emulate it through his words, that we are not imagining it? Or how do we know that he himself is not imagining the Vedic, Upanishadic seers' words? How do we know, and add infinitive, how do we know that these are all not mind tricks that our minds are playing in their imagination, and nothing more than that?
Well, he's communicating something to us. We will only know whether what he's communicating to us when we have the experience. But it seems that there's something in us which recognizes this as truth. And that's the part in us which could have the experience. I think the reason why we all gather here and revel in these words, it's because somehow, even though we can't fully understand them, they bring us something that is valuable and true. And of course our imagination is a capacity which the Lord has given us to help us. It's not a substitute for the truth, but it can point us towards something that may become real. And then when we have the experience, we recognize how far our imagination was correct and how far it was distorted.
So we use the imagination as a tool or like a ladder to ascend or whatever.
Yes, yes. That's one of the great functions of art, all kinds of art. That the artist ideally, in his consciousness, gets in touch with subtler levels of truth, not just the purely material, and then tries whatever wonderful experience he might have had in those subtler worlds of imagination and inspiration, he tries to give a material form to that for himself to see and to maybe be able to share with others. And if I've understood Mother and Sri Aurobindo correctly, they say that is the true function of the artist, to bring something, some potential from higher worlds into a close contact with our material world. And that can lead to new realizations here in the world of matter.
He deals with that matter of imagination, I would say, in these lines 143 to 4. Dreaming, she chases her idea of him and catches Hero looking there at Jesse.
Yes.
So
yes.
It may be an approximation, but whatever you get towards it is a great experience.
A touch or a glimpse, yeah.
I'm always thinking about, I don't even think, I mean, to me, what does the word Lord mean? When you speak that, I don't even know what you're talking about, truly. And when we divide into he and she, I'm always challenged to go beyond that, because I'm quite sure that our some consciousness, some existence, some being is well beyond that
separation, of course.
And so we have this description of the secret knowledge. I think we even have to break beyond these words. You know, is it also possible that a person could say, you know, I don't even really believe in God, so how does this work for me?
Right. Mother has written or said that I didn't have anything to do with God. I didn't want to know about God. Only when I met Sri Aurobindo, he explained to me, and then I understood. So what God means in Sri Aurobindo's expression, there's a place in The Life Divine where he explains that. For us, it's a label. It's a label that we put on what we conceive to be a higher, maybe the highest reality. And in India, that is seen as taking many, many different forms of expression, but perhaps the supreme one as the Lord, Ishwara, Brahman, Purusha, and the dynamic feminine counterpart. And Mother has given her sanction to this, you know, that she's written to one of the teachers of the school. Always remember that the feminine is the dynamic part. You can lean on a conception that's come to you from a male, but don't forget, you are the executrix, you represent the active force. So it's a differentiation of function for the play. Sri Aurobindo has also said it. The mother's force and mine are the same, and we are here in two bodies for the play. And he's going to beautifully describe to us this play in the coming sections. But the origin is the one who takes these roles for the play, as Lorraine said, for his own amusement.
That differentiation is only at the over-mental level. The supermind, there is no gender separation. But that the Ishwara Shakti is an eternal truth at that level.
Yes, Don.
Isn't this the Gnostic being that we find in the Life Divine? This is what we are to be, that Gnostic being, and we've been talking this time.
Shobindo's trying to give us a glimpse, or is giving us a glimpse which we are trying to catch, of something he calls the omnipresent reality, the underlying truth of everything. But because of the way that our minds and our perceptions are formed, then that omnipresent reality is expressed to us, can be communicated to us in different aspects. But all these are aspects of one reality, one truth.
Could we, in one way, relate to Aurobindo's experience, Sarvabhoomi Vasudeva?
Yeah, that's what it's all about, yes. Let's read just a little bit further before we close today. Who is next in the line? Rosa? Oh, Kenge, you would read, please. Seen. Yes, thank you. No, let's pause there. He moves there as the soul, as nature, she. We'll stop there today. This is one evocation of the relationship between the two who are one. The universe is an endless masquerade, a play of disguises. Nothing here in the material world is utterly what it seems. What is it? A dream, fact, vision of a truth which but for the dream would not be wholly true. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.